So this is a list that I'm going to talk about today. It's a list that Kevin and Kirsty and I are going to use to make up the final. So you could think of one question from each of these topics along the way. So you don't have to learn a lot of other stuff. Now, I can't guarantee that it's going to be limited just to this, but this is a good way to focus. And this list will be on BSpace if it's not already. Do we have it there yet?
Not yet.
No, but we will. Okay. And so what I wanted to do was just start at the very beginning and talk about what we've been doing this whole semester. Right. Okay. So we started out talking about this kind of stuff, the fact that in order to get the nervous system to work, you need batteries. And the batteries are made by creating concentration gradients, more concentration on this side than on this side. But in addition to concentration gradients, you also need a selectively permeable channel. And that's this channel here. And when that channel opens, one of the ions that existed on this side moves over to this side. And in this case, red is positive, let's say. So it makes this side positive with respect to this one. And eventually, this becomes so positive that it's pushing the positive ions back that way, and you come to equilibrium. So that's the Nernst relation, and that's the establishment of a battery. Now, every one of the billions of neurons in your brain has at least two or three or four of these batteries, and they're constantly being charged up by pumps that use ATP. And this is the basis for everything that we've been talking about. This is another example of the same kind of thing, but put in the context of a neuron, where there's a higher concentration outside than in, and when the selectively permeable channel opens, you get a buildup of some charge here, charge separation. So this represents one of the batteries, and of course there are always more than one battery. And the battery values are given by the Nernst relation, which is in here, but you don't have to know that, really. Okay. When there are more than one battery in a cell, the membrane potential is established by the relationship between the conductances related to the different batteries. And so think of this as a magic hand here that's opening these gates. And we've talked about a lot of different ways that the gates get opened. But in this case, it's the relative opening of these gates that determines the membrane potential. And what's interesting about this is that if the membrane were at the equilibrium potential for either of these ions, let's say this one, no current is flowing. No current is flowing through the sodium channel here because the sodium gate is closed. That's what brought the membrane to minus 80 millivolts because it's completely dominated by the potassium channel. And no current is flowing through the potassium channel because it's at the equilibrium potential for potassium. And the same thing exists up at the other end where, at this case, there's no current flowing through the potassium channel because it's closed, and there's no current flowing through the sodium channel even though it's open because it's at the equilibrium potential. And everywhere in between, which is where neurons operate, there's always going to be an outward flow of potassium and an inward flow of sodium. Yeah?
So do you mean like there's no current at all or no net current?
Is there no current at all or no net current?
Or is there no net current?
In this case, there's no, both of those are true.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah. But they're not going to be so detailed that you can like only read this lecture's notes and get the final. So there will be there'll be details, but not so that detailed.
There's another thing that I could do, which is to put this voice online. This whole recording of what I'm saying today could be there. Why not? I mean, I'll have to listen to all the silly things that I'm saying, like what I'm saying now, but it could be there. I won't edit it, but you know, I could give you that. And then, you know, if you think not about equilibrium, but about the steady state, the system is looking like this, for the resting channels anyway, which are operating somewhere between the equilibrium potentials for sodium and potassium. And so there's always an inward flow of sodium and always an outward flow of potassium. And those concentration gradients get reestablished by the pumps that are driven by ATP. So that's the energy source for this kind of thing. Now, the most interesting or the most complex set of interactions are the ones related to the action potential. And we've talked about that over and over again here. And there are three gates involved here. First, there's the sodium activation gate that opens and allows sodium to come in. Sodium inactivation gate that closes to shut off sodium. And then the potassium activation gate that opens that allows potassium to leave. So if we had looked at the timing of all of this, the sodium activation gate is open during this region. Sodium inactivation gate closes around here. And the membrane is pulled down in the negative direction toward the equilibrium potential for potassium. Because the potassium gate is kind of dumb and sluggish and takes a long time to close after it's open, even though the membrane has gotten strongly hyperpolarized. And the membrane comes back to the resting level again. Okay. So this is actually it's a simple one, but it's my favorite animation because you're really looking at the way sodium and potassium channels work, but it's also a way of thinking about how Hodgkin and Huxley, who got the Nobel Prize for understanding this, looked at things as well. Now, in the bigger scheme of things, the membrane involves the resting channels as well. And this is the condition just at threshold. So what happened was the membrane got slightly depolarized to start this whole process. And remember when we talked about this before, people were saying, well, how does it get polarized in the first place? And that's because I hadn't talked to you about synaptic transmission yet. So something has happened somewhere else in the system that's depolarized the cell. It's gotten an excitatory input, which has brought it to this level, which we call threshold. Okay. And at the threshold level, because the membrane is more depolarized than the resting level, there's going to be an outward flow of current through the resting channels, which is going to try to pull the membrane back to the resting level. But at the same time, the sodium activation gate begins to open, and then there's an inward current here. And at the point where these two currents are balanced, that's the threshold level. If the membrane gets a little bit more depolarized than that, the sodium channels open even more, and that's going to allow the membrane to depolarize even further. This is the upward swing over here, and you see this membrane coming up. And at some point near the top of all of this, the inactivation gate closes. In this case, it's an inactivation ball. Okay? And from then on, the membrane is brought back to the resting level by both the potassium channel and the resting channels, which are both having outward currents. The potassium channel sort of remains open during this overshoot and pulls the membrane even more negative, and then it moves back to the resting level. Okay. And you remember this one, which is one of the reasons that we have an action potential in the first place, which is to amplify this polarization that starts near the cell body or in the dendrites as a result of the synaptic input. But you have this long, skinny axon where the current falls away, where the potential falls away very quickly. And so you have to have a series of these sodium-potassium gates that carry the action potential along. And when the action potential reaches the synaptic terminal, because of depolarization, the voltage-dependent calcium channels open, calcium enters the membrane, calcium facilitates the fusion of synaptic vesicles with the membrane, and there's synaptic release. Okay. So we've now got three voltage-dependent channels that we talked about, the sodium and potassium channels associated with the action potential and the voltage-dependent calcium channel as well. And this is just a closer-up view of the of synaptic release. Those are the calcium channels. These are the vesicles that fuse with the membrane, release the transmitter, which activates postsynaptic receptors. In this case, this looks like ionotropic receptors, where the transmitter directly opens the postsynaptic receptors. But you know that in addition to the ionotropic receptors, there are many others which involve second messengers. And the role of these second messengers is to amplify the effects of each of these channels, of each of the bindings of the transmitter to the channels. Okay. This is a more complete picture of the whole story, where the resting channels here, the calcium channel here, synaptic release, the postsynaptic receptors, which can be either excitatory or inhibitory, the resting channels, action potential channels, the whole story, but you got that. So here is a very simple animation just showing the mechanism of ionotropic reception, where the transmitter binds to the receptor, causes the receptor to itself, to the channel of the receptor to open, and current flows through. The next more complicated one is where the GTP opens the receptor. There's a binding to the receptor, opens the channel. A G protein binds to the channel and opens it. And then there's the sort of classic second messenger system that involves cyclic AMP. And this, or a variation of this, seems to exist just about everywhere, where the ligand binds the receptor. It activates the G protein. The G protein activates adenylyl cyclase, the synthetic enzyme that makes cyclic AMP. Cyclic AMP binds to the kinase, which phosphorylates the channel. The channel, well, in this case, opens, but there are examples where channels close or disappear as well. And we'll talk about those a little bit later on. So maybe I'm going a little bit too fast, but I wanted to, this is all review. You know all this stuff anyway, right? And then one other interesting kind of channel, which is the NMDA channel. And I think of this as a coincidence channel. This is the channel that's going to be useful for associative memory, those kinds of things, where two events have to happen simultaneously. One of them is that the AMPA receptor has to be activated, and the other is that simultaneously the NMDA receptor has to be activated. Because if you activate the AMPA receptor alone, nothing much is going to happen over here. You can pull the magnesium out of this binding, but glutamate hasn't arrived there yet. And if glutamate arrives here, nothing's going to happen because magnesium is stuck in there. But if the two occur simultaneously, then you can remove the magnesium, you can also activate this channel, and you get an inward current, and also in many of these channels, an inward flow of calcium, which acts as a second messenger. And there have been many examples of that that we talked about throughout the semester. A couple of other a couple of other metabotropic and ionotropic receptor pairs, for example, for acetylcholine. There's the muscarinic receptor is metabotropic. The nicotinic receptor is ionotropic. I'm not even going to run the animation of that. And the same is true for GABA. Remember, all of these transmitters are permissive. They allow something to happen postsynaptically. But what happens postsynaptically depends upon what kind of receptor happens to exist on the postsynaptic membrane. Yeah. So I've skipped over all of the taste stuff because the next most interesting postsynaptic receptor type is the one that's involved in olfaction. And that's simply a variation on the cyclic AMP system that I showed you a little bit earlier, the classical system. But it's different because in olfaction, there's no kinase. What happens here, whoops, you know what's coming, is that there's binding to the receptor. The receptor activates the G protein. G protein activates adenylyl cyclase. But the cyclic AMP, instead of going through a kinase, acts directly on the channel, opens it, and causes an inward flow of sodium, but also an inward flow of calcium. And in this case, this is unique to most receptor types, this calcium activates a chloride channel. And you remember that the chloride concentration in these cells is reversed from what it normally is. Normally, chloride is inhibitory, but in this case, the chloride flows in the other direction and is excitatory. So these two events depolarize the olfactory receptor. And the olfactory receptor has its own axon that carries information up to the olfactory bulb, where all of these olfactory receptors join at the glomeruli. But I don't have a picture of that, and I'm not going to ask you to know about that. Another fascinating receptor type is the one that exists in rods and cones. And again, it's a variation on the cyclic nucleotide second messenger system. In this case, the effect of light is to get rid of this double bond here on this 11 cis retinol. Remember, this is all in this terribly tightly configured, uncomfortable position. And the effect of light is to allow it to relax. And there it goes, let's see, relaxing here. And that's a signal to opsin, a seven membrane spanning protein, to do its receptor thing, which activates a G protein, which in this case is called transducin. And the effect of transducin, unlike most of the other receptors, instead of activating a synthetic enzyme, it activates a degradative enzyme, phosphodiesterase. So the sodium channels in the outer segment of the photoreceptors are held open by the presence of the cyclic nucleotide. And the effect of phosphodiesterase is to chew up the second messenger so that the sodium channels close. When sodium channels close, what happens? Sodium is always pulling the membrane in the positive direction. So when those channels close, the membrane hyperpolarizes. And here's a simple example. Well, it's the same thing, just indicating that the phosphodiesterase is going to chew up the second messenger and allow the channels to close and less flow of sodium. But here's the picture that I was thinking about, which is that when the sodium channels close, this is the normal state in the dark, a lot of sodium current entering the outer segment, keeping the membrane depolarized, and the effect of light is to close those channels and the membrane hyperpolarizes. So all photoreceptors, all vertebrate photoreceptors operate in this way. The second messenger is degraded by the phosphodiesterase. The second messenger is holding the channel open. These channels close, the membrane hyperpolarizes. So looking down through the rest of the visual system, here are the photoreceptors which are driving, remember, two kinds of bipolar cells, the on-bipolars and the off-bipolars. The off-bipolar cells have ionotropic receptors, so they follow the photoreceptors. When the photoreceptors hyperpolarize, the off-bipolar cells hyperpolarize. When the photoreceptors hyperpolarize, the on-bipolars depolarize, so there's an opposite movement of the two bipolar cell types. And they create kind of neural images of the visual world. Okay. All of these cells throughout the visual system. Do you have a question? No, I left taste out because it's just memorizing a whole bunch of. I can't keep them straight, so why should you? Okay. This is to illustrate the notion of receptive field. All sensory neurons in all parts of all sensory systems have receptive fields. And the way they're measured is by scanning across the receptive surface. It could be the skin or photoreceptors or something in the olfactory system, if you could find it, or the auditory system. You scan across that surface, and you measure from some cell deep in the system how it responds to movement across that surface. So in this case, this is a bipolar cell, but it could have just as well been a cortical cell or a lateral geniculate cell. And as you flash along here, you begin to see responses developing in this cell. When you're in the periphery of this cell, the responses move in one direction. When the flashing light comes near the center of the cell so that it's directly driving the dendrites of the cell, the potential moves in the other direction and moving out the other side again. You get a negative going response. So you would call this a center surround receptive field, where the center illumination at the center drives the cell in one direction, illumination in the surround drives it in the other direction. And you remember we talked a lot about this, that the surround is formed by the blurred image that comes from these tightly coupled horizontal cells. And when you subtract a blurred image from a sharp image, you can accentuate the edges. And I showed you a lot of examples of that, and even a number of visual illusions. Now, picking out various things around here, but I don't want to go into that right now. Okay. So in addition to this straight-through pathway from photoreceptors to bipolar to ganglion cells, there is this interneuron, this big blurry thing that feeds both back to photoreceptors and forward to bipolar cells. And it's the interactions here that generate these receptive fields that I showed you. You stimulate over here. There are other photoreceptors here as well. They're going to have an inhibitory effect on this pathway, whereas if you stimulate directly here, they're going to have an excitatory effect. And that's where the excitatory-inhibitory interaction takes place. And this would be useful because it gives you an idea of what these different components look like in real life. So this is me in the photoreceptor layer, and the bright parts are kind of coming out of the screen. And here, this orange, yellow picture is what the blurred image in the horizontal cells look like. And it's the difference between those two that generates the next level of activity in the bipolar cells. And the bipolar cells are of two types. So these would be the on-bipolars, where brightness is coming out of the screen, and dark areas around my eyes are receding into the screen. Think of the in and out as being membrane potential. So it's more depolarized in the light areas and hyperpolarized in the dark areas. This would be the neural image that exists in the population of on-bipolar cells. And this is the neural image that exists in the population of off-bipolar cells, because they're going to look at offness. The dark parts are the ones that are emphasized. So these pits where my eyes are now become mountains over here. And this mountain where my hair used to be becomes a sort of a dark pit there. So the point of this is just to indicate that moving all through the visual system, there are these two complementary streams of activity. And I show them separated here, but actually they overlap. These cells are completely intertwined throughout the visual system. And this on and off activity that begins at the dendrites of the bipolar cells is carried through to ganglion cells, the lateral geniculate cells, and to cortical cells as well. But the initiation of on-off differences happens in the dendrites of the bipolar cells because of the two different types of receptors, the ionotropic receptors and the metabotropic receptors. There are more interactions that take place in the inner retina, and I haven't talked about those too much in this course. What they do is to generate a series of movies that exist in the retina and are carried intact through the optic nerve. And the overall inner retina is organized in this way, where there are about 10 layers. Each layer is subserved, roughly speaking, by a different bipolar cell type that its axon terminal exists at each of these layers for both the off and the on cell types. And each of these layers is reached up to by a distinct class of ganglion cell that is reading out activity from those bipolar cells. And of course, there are a lot of amacrine cells, interneurons involved as well. And the result of all of this operation is that the retina delivers to the brain about a dozen different movies, each one a different representation of the visual world, a different abstraction. And this is a movie that kind of illustrates that. This is made from a model of all of the data that we got from each of these different layers. And what I've done here is to show you what they look like, what each of the, how I would be represented in each of seven of the 12 different layers. And if I let this model run a little bit, you can see what the differences are, because I colored each of these differently. And if you merge them all, and I just stop this at any point along the way, what you can see is that each color exists in a different region of my face. And the interpretation of that is that each of these different ganglion cell types that's reading a different aspect of the visual world is picking out some different aspect of my face. The orange guy around here, which is, we know is a kind of an edge detector, is picking out the edges, the outside edges, actually, of my face. And there's a white one here that's a kind of a blob detector that picks out these things. And there's another one here, which is a highlight detector, and another one down in here, which is kind of a shadow detector. And a lot of the detectors I can't even describe because they were made up by nature, not by people, so they don't actually have names. But just to remember that there are at least 12 different types. And then carrying information through from the retina to higher areas, there's the optic nerve, which through the optic chiasm carries information to the thalamus, the lateral geniculate, and ultimately to the visual cortex, which is here. And I remember when I talked about this slide, I said there are three different ways of thinking about how the visual system is organized. You can think about it in terms of the anatomy of the pathways, the physiology and the receptive fields, and the architecture. And I left out all of those movies about the physiology that show the different cell types, the simple, the concentric, simple, and complex cell types, because I thought it would take too long to get through all of that. But one of the main points is that wherever you look throughout the visual system, information is organized in a retinotopic way. That is, at every layer, remember, there were all of those layers that existed in the retina, and there are six different layers that exist in primate lateral geniculate, and there are six different layers that exist in visual cortex. Each layer is organized as a kind of an intact map of visual space, but at each layer, the representation is modified in some way by synaptic interactions. So here are the six layers that exist in the lateral geniculate. And you remember that these are I alternating layers. Let's say left, right, left, right, right, left, right, so on. Okay. There aren't six layers in all animals. In cats, there are.